Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 267. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can go to the Twitter. You can type in The Show Is So Gay. You can follow us there. And of course, go to the Facebook. Type in The Show Is So Gay. Like us. Because we sure as heck like you. What a fun show we have for you this week. We must get started with our first guest. Adam Feldman reviews theater and cabaret for Time Out New York. For the last decade, he has served as the president of the New York Drama Critics Circle. He's also one of the most prolific and entertaining Facebookers out there in all the feeds. And now he is here with us. Adam Feldman, welcome to The Show Is So Gay.
Hi there, glad to be here. Episode 267.
Episode number 267. Right? That's the one. You know, all podcasts and radio shows jump the shark in 267, so I'm happy you're here.
That's
with
what
us.
I'm going for, shark jumping.
That's when they book you. You're known as the go-to guy for that.
I'll take it.
We have so much ground to cover. Are you ready?
Sure.
First, I must wish you a belated Happy Canada Day.
Thank you. I am Canadian, or yo soy canadiense, as they say in my homeland.
I know nothing about Canada Day or what it means.
Of course not, because you live in the United States. Nobody does. It's just an empty spot above the map.
Well, Paula Poundstone calls it America's hat, which I appreciate.
Yeah, no, that's sweet. It's an enormous country, but it doesn't have that many people in it. And most of the people who live in it live fairly close to the American border, in part because of the trade and in part because it's very, very cold further up than that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a lovely place to grow up.
Tell us about life growing up in Montreal.
Well, I did grow up in Montreal, which is different from elsewhere in Canada in that it's part of Quebec, and so it is majoritarily French in its culture. I grew up in an English-speaking Jewish-Canadian family, so
wow.
I spoke English at home, and most of my friends spoke English, but we were part of the Anglophone minority in Montreal, and I spent a lot of time learning French in school. I actually learned French in school before I learned English, which is a handy thing to have in my pocket for when I do New York Times crossword puzzles. And
there you
like
go.
That.
There you go.
And just, I think, generally having a second language is a smart thing to have done.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I didn't choose to do it, but I'm very glad that it happened to me. I think it does sort of open up your perspective in some way.
You then made the decision, hey, I'm going to leave Canada and go to Harvard.
Yes. Well, it was very cold in Canada. And also, I was lucky enough to get into the school that I wanted to go to, and so I went and had a lovely time there. Hasty Pudding theatricals.
Nice.
Including one show written by Larry O'Keefe, who went on to write Legally Blonde and Bat Boy, and another show written by David Jabberbaum, who went on to write Cry Baby, and many excellent special material bits for the Tony Awards.
Did you do any theater reviewing while at Harvard?
No, I didn't. I wrote an angry letter to the editor once about a theater review, so that counts.
Were you in the show that was angry or was,
I was
not
was
well reviewed?
It was a Hasty Pudding show. I must admit, it's sort of one of the proudest I've been of a piece of writing that I did. It was full of righteous, sarcastic indignation. And it was like almost a full page long.
I was going to ask you, because, you know, we have so many reviewers and writers and journalists on our show, and we always ask them, how would you describe your journalistic voice? My assumption is that yours would be angry and standing up and sarcastic. I don't know. How would you describe your voice?
Yeah, it's actually not, I don't think.
Righteous.
That was certainly
that was
my voice
yeah.
as a righteous artist affronted by a poorly thought through review in college. As a reviewer, I don't try to do that. I try to, you know, I have a lot of rules about the way that I write these reviews, and part of the difficulty is that I write for Time Out New York. It is a wonderful magazine, but it is aimed at presenting fairly brief summaries or reviews of what is available to do in the city that week, and so we have a fairly limited space, usually, in which to review a given show. And so if you want to get in the information that you want in there, and you also want to get in some opinion and a context and some maybe a read on the show, especially if it's a more difficult show, and also make it entertaining for the reader to enjoy by inserting your own jokes and you know, observations and whatnot.
Right.
You have very little space in which to do that. So it becomes an art of compression, really. It's a miniaturist's art. It's like, you know, in medieval times when they would draw angels on the top of pins. You try to get in as much information as you can in a fairly short space. But I actually, I mean, you know, there's certainly, I've written my share of snarky reviews, but I do try to save those for ones, for targets that I consider to be appropriate.
Yes.
You know, otherwise you're just being mean. And I do try to remember as much as I can how hard it is to do good work, even if you're extremely talented and extremely well-intentioned and extremely intelligent. There are so many factors that go into making a good work of art that the fact that something didn't work doesn't necessarily mean it's a suitable target for derision.
Right.
And so when there are different kinds of negative reviews that you can write. You can write a respectful negative review that says, hey, they're trying to do this interesting thing, and I don't think it works. And occasionally, you do want to write a sort of a more fun one, because readers like reading it, and sometimes the targets are deserving.
Yeah.
Talk to me, let's take a step back even further, because it is very clear from what you write and your Facebook presence, which we'll talk about as well, that you really do have a love for theater and cabaret.
Well, yeah, and thank God, because otherwise my job would be hell.
It would be horrible.
I mean, I see, I would say about 300 shows a year.
That's a lot.
And I'm also at the office. I mean, I'm a staff writer at the magazine, so I'm at the office for 40 hours a week, and then I go most nights to a show. Now, I'm not complaining about that. This is the life I've chosen and the life that I often enjoy. And there are many perks of it, mainly that I get to see a lot of shows that I otherwise probably wouldn't be able to afford to see.
Right.
And also that I get to see them from good seats and with the original cast, and that's all wonderful. The flip side of that sword, the other edge of that sword, is that I have to see a lot of things that I otherwise would never see.
Right.
And it's my job to take the bullet to some extent for a lot of these shows. Because even if I'm not reviewing it, there are many shows that I have to see for other reasons, because I'm tracking people's careers or because I vote for certain awards. And so that can be depressing.
Yeah.
Because bad theater, you know, the burnout risk is high, because bad theater is worse than bad television or bad film. It's more uncomfortable. You're right there.
We asked your colleague, Eric Pippenberg, he was on the show a few weeks ago, and who also sees quite a few shows as well, and we will ask you the same question. Even knowing that you do have to review things, are there ones that you have walked out during intermission?
Yes. I don't walk out at intermission of anything that I have to review.
Okay.
I've walked out of things that I thought I might review on spec, and I actually did that fairly recently to one particular show, where I sort of went thinking, well, if I like it, I'll review it, and if not, then there's no point.
Okay.
Writing a bad review.
Generally, because we are not a show that flames anyone. We're a happy, positive little family show, family little gay show. What could they be doing different that would cause you to stay in your seat past intermission? What are some general mistakes that some shows are making?
Oh, gosh, it's really hard. Well, I mean, mostly it's just that they're terrible.
Yeah,
that's rough. And harder to describe than that, it's that I have a fairly high tolerance level for theater. I'm rooting for it, and even if it's bad, often I find it's worth staying just to see why it's bad, and
right.
Sometimes you can learn from that. You know, you can figure out more about how the system works and how the art works by seeing it not work. So that can be very useful. If it's genuinely painful, especially if it's boring, that's when I'm most likely to leave. And then there are times also when I'm in a mood and I'm tired and I know it's not even the show's fault necessarily. The show's fine.
Right.
But I'm not writing about it. I've seen what I need to see of it, and I feel like I've given it my time. But I really leave very, very seldom. I would say leaving at intermission for me happens maybe once every 4 or 5 months.
Not so bad.
Yeah. No, I really very rarely do it.
Okay.
I avoid it.
Do you recall the first theater review that you put out there to the world?
Oh gosh, I don't really remember. I was writing about theater in a sort of critical, informally critical way before I was doing it formally. So I don't remember. It was some small show, I think.
Okay.
But I didn't really seek out theater criticism. I kind of got recruited to it, which was just an interesting trajectory for a critic.
Someone was at a bar one time and said, come with me to this. And then, because that's what I just concocted in my head.
One-man show.
I've used that line, Adam. It's not successful.
No, I had graduated from college, and I was working at a day job, and I was bored sometimes at the office, and I would play around on the internet. And I ended up on a discussion group for musical theater, and I got into many heated, useful arguments about, you know, various shows that I didn't or did like. And when the magazine Show Business Weekly started up again, this is in the late 90s, early 2000s, late 90s, someone from the magazine contacted me and said, we're looking for reviewers, and we like what you've been writing online in these discussion groups, and do you have any interest in writing reviews for us? And I thought, well, gosh, sure, that sounds like fun. So I did, and started doing it on the side for my regular job, and then things led to things. I met the editor of Broadway.com, and he asked me to send him some of my stuff, and I did, and he liked it, so I started writing for them instead. And then a job opened up at Time Out, and they wrote me and asked me if I would write for them. So it's been sort of unusual in that way. It wasn't ever really something I sought out.
For folks who don't know Time Out, you gave us a brief description. Tell everyone about Time Out New York. You know, as a former New York City guy, I miss Time Out so much. I don't even look at it because I get upset because I see all the stuff that I'm not doing this weekend.
Well, Time Out I'm not shilling for the magazine, buy it or don't, but I really like the magazine. I use it all the time myself. Basically, it's a guide to what's happening week to week in the city. And there are different sections for, you know, for theater, for film, for art, for gay and lesbian,
yeah,
for music, for shopping, for burlesque and nightclub experiences, you know. And there's hundreds and hundreds of listings of the hundreds and hundreds of events that are happening in the city in any given week. I'm talking about the print magazine now, but there also, of course, is an extensive online
right
version of it. And for me, it's a nice way to navigate the sometimes daunting maze of possibilities that is available to you in New York. There's just so much going on,
yeah,
in this city. And so it's a curated source of information about some of the best events or the most interesting events that are happening week to week. And so it has different rules, section to section also. For example, I write for the music section, too, because I cover cabaret music. And we don't really write reviews in music. We write previews, because most shows only play for a few days.
Right.
By the time, and we're a weekly magazine, so by the time we wrote a review, it would be, hey, here's what you should have seen 2 weeks ago, which isn't really very useful. So we do that for theater reviews because the shows are still playing.
Right.
And in music, we tend to write previews.
And you mentioned it, but really not insignificant that this major magazine has a gay and lesbian section.
That's true. It does. And Ethan McCroy runs it, and he's a lovely guy and very smart, and puts together a nice assemblage of different events and parties and shows every week of gay and lesbian interest.
Speaking of, when you know that you're going to be reviewing a show that has LGBT content in it, is that something that you look forward to more? Are you more critical? Does it not make a difference? What goes on in your head?
You know, it's a complicated question. I think that everyone has their, like Elaine Stritch says in her documentary, everyone's got their own sack of rocks, you know?
Yeah.
Everyone brings their own experience to their experience of a show. As a critic, generally, I try to take a step back after seeing a show and separate out my own experience from my critical experience and my own taste, small t, from my own sense of taste, capital T, to the extent that taste, capital T, can exist in a non-problematic way, which is a separate and complicated conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But to the extent that there's such thing as objective taste, you do want to aspire to it. You don't want to just be like, I like this actress because she reminds me of my sister. That may be true as an audience member, but it shouldn't be true as a critic. And so you do try to separate those things out. Certainly, since I'm gay and since I'm a Jewish and since I went to college and since I'm cisgender and since I'm male and since I'm middle class and since I live in New York and all the other senses, I have my own particular set of experiences and perspectives that I bring to anything I see. And I don't want to suggest that they're only representative of those categories that I just gave either.
Right.
They're also specific to my own experience and my own philosophy. But, you know, you try to find a middle ground. You try to be fair and open and thoughtful. I certainly know a lot more about gay theater just because I've seen a lot more of it than most people have, and probably than most of my colleagues, because
yeah.
It's an interest of mine and it connects to me. But I've certainly loved a lot of gay plays, and I've hated a lot of gay plays. I don't give extra points to a play for being gay or for having gay content. And there may be even some ways in which I respond more negatively to it. I've never particularly liked the work of Terrence McNally.
There you go.
At least not the work that he's done in the past 20 years. And part of it for me is that it seems so familiar from a gay perspective. It seems so comfily Upper West Side.
Right.
In its understanding of what gay life is. And it seems to me often over-obvious and explanatory to what the playwright seems to imagine is an audience that desperately needs educating about social issues. And that's not the kind of drama that I like. I like drama that is grounded in specifics and in deeper, more personal dynamics.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense.
As soon as I feel like I'm being preached to about a lesson, as like I'm supposed to learn a lesson from something, I feel like, well, screw you, I already know that.
Right.
And I don't need to have you tell me that from the stage.
And then it also brings up the question of who was it written for, because I think in some of those cases, probably not you, Adam.
Yeah, that may be true.
Yeah.
Except it has a lot of gay fans. I mean, Terrence's work certainly does.
Yeah.
There are things that I like in McNally's work, don't get me wrong. There are moments in it that I like. And I thought his latest one, Mothers and Sons, was his best in a long time. But if I want to read an essay, I'll read an essay. You know.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Well, we were in California this year for the San Francisco to LA AIDS ride. So this is the first time in a long while that I missed the Tony Awards. I did not see even a minute of the Tony Awards. You, I know, did see the Tony Awards.
I live tweeted them.
I know. I was just going to say that was kind of my way of living, you know, through you watching the Tony Awards. You also did put out there a really nice piece. I like lists sometimes. Sometimes I don't like lists, but most of the times I like them. I like the 25 best Tony Awards performances list that you put out there.
Oh, I have to say, that's really one of my favorite things that I've ever written.
Look at that.
That really shows. Thank you. I'm glad that you brought that one up because I'm awfully proud of that one. And the funny thing is that it's now 3 years old, but every year we put it up, and every year it's a huge success. We put it up around Tony time, and every year it's a huge success. It just keeps on finding new people who like it, not because of my work in it, which I'm proud of, but also just because it's a great way to pull together 25 of the best Tony Award performances of all time and just watch them, and they're all terrific. So it happens to fill a void. But yes, if you look up, you know, on Google, if you look up best Tony performances, it'll come up pretty early on the Google search, like in the top five, I think.
I resisted for so many years just not even, you know, really watching the Jennifer Holliday performance of thinking, because it's, oh, I'm sure it's just such a gay cliche. There's no way it's ever going to live up to the hype. And then, you know, maybe when I was 20, 21, finally just sat down and watched it. And yeah, it really does live up to the hype, doesn't it?
It exceeds any possible hype. And the thing is, I worry about overpraising some of these things, but in this case, it's really impossible to overpraise. If you give yourself over to it, then it is just plain awe-inspiring.
Yeah.
It's one of the most amazing performances that's ever been on television, period. And it it's a very big performance. So there is a way in which you can find it embarrassing in the way that people find theater embarrassing on television. But it's so fiercely committed. It dares you to, it stares you down.
Yeah.
And it makes you stay. It does the thing, ironically enough, it does the thing that the singer of the song is unable to do to the man she's singing to, which is it forces you to stay.
Right. Oh, my gosh, because you're scared to leave.
Yeah, it's terrifying. And Jennifer Holliday, when you watch this performance, it's shocking to think that she was actually only 21 years old.
Yeah.
What Michael Bennett got out of her and what she had in her to get out is just really breathtaking. But there's so much else in that list that, I mean, it's just I love the Michael Jeter Grand Hotel dance sequence. That's in my top five. I might even move it up a little bit if I were writing that list again today, because that's the one that maybe, other than the Holiday, that's the one I've watched the most myself over the years. It's, if you're ever depressed, just go and watch Michael Jeter in that Grand Hotel Raise a Glass Together sequence. It is unbelievably joyous.
Over the past year, I've rewatched Neil Patrick Harris's opening to last year's Tonys many, many, many times. Is there anything from this year? I swear to you, I have not even seen a minute of it. Now we're going on like a month later. Is there anything that I should be going on YouTube and watching from this past year's Tonys?
No, it wasn't. Look, I mean, it was a perfectly fine season. A perfectly fine season. But it didn't have... I think that what people may watch again is Idina Menzel's song from If Then, because she really knocked the socks off of it.
Okay.
And, you know, but the funny thing about Radio City, and I've mentioned this, I've whined about this many times before in print, but when the Tonys moved from doing the awards ceremony in a Broadway theater to doing it at Radio City Music Hall, it really lost a lot, and it continues to. The space is just too big. The dance numbers that are meant for a narrower space look spaced out. They're not. They don't look tight. And the cameras are all trying to make it look active by shooting it from different angles, and it's not meant to be seen that way. So it just looks sloppy. The paradox of that is that actually the smaller numbers tend to do better because the cameras are more focused.
Right.
And so you can have great numbers, and we have had great numbers at Radio City. I mean, most notably, Patti LuPone's Everything's Coming Up Roses from Gypsy a few years ago. It's just extraordinary. But you can do that because basically it's a small, tight focus. And the big, dazzling musical numbers that kill in the theater get a little lost in a 6,000-seat venue.
Yeah.
Like the number from Aladdin is just pure musical theater, old-fashioned showbiz glitz, joy in, you know, at the New Amsterdam, and at Radio City it just looked huffy and puffy.
Now, do any of these folks ever get in touch with you? Say you do write something that,
right,
even in its brevity, perhaps doesn't go as well. And by the way, I would like to, do you recall how you summed up The Last Smoker in America, which, by the way, I had never heard of. I had never heard of that production.
That wasn't a very good show.
No, apparently it wasn't. Do you remember the two words that you used to describe that particular show?
Why don't you remind me?
I do believe you wrote "butt ugly" right there. See what you did there,
okay.
Adam?
Yes. I do enjoy making puns. But here's what I'll say also.
Yes.
I know people think that the fun of reviews is the really mean ones, and to some extent that's true. They are a lot of fun to read, and everyone in the industry, despite what they may say, enjoys the schadenfreude of a really vicious review.
Those okay.
ones that you remember, and they're funnier, and you can be funnier in them. But I think the assumption is sometimes that critics are sadists. I'm speaking only for myself. I can say that I don't think that that's the case. I really, actually, my favorite kinds of reviews to write are for shows that I love. Those are the ones that I'm proudest of, generally. Or, I guess, you know, after that, there's some, you know, shows that I hate but which are fun to write about because the stakes are so low, because they're just commercial or they're just cheap.
Yeah.
For example, if you want to read the review that gets brought up, the negative review that I wrote that gets brought up to me the most in a fun way is the one I wrote for a musical called Wonderland.
Okay.
It was a musical by Frank Wildhorn, who wrote Jekyll and Hyde and many other bad shows. And this was his Alice in Wonderland riff from a few years ago, and I wrote it in the style of Lewis Carroll's Jabberwock. Jabberwocky. And I must say, you know, if you're going to write a bad review, I was awfully proud of this one.
That's awesome.
But the reviews that I'm proudest of, honestly, are the ones where I'm sticking up for something new or interesting, and especially when other people haven't gotten it. The review that I'm proudest of maybe in my career is the review that I wrote of Tony Kushner and Janine Tesori's Caroline or Change.
Yeah.
In 2003 and 2004, because I reviewed it twice when it was off-Broadway and on. And I think it's one of the great musicals, maybe my favorite musical of the past 20 years. And it was not given the critical reception generally in New York that it deserved. It has since, but not when it opened. People weren't ready for it. And I loved it, and I said so, and I'm very proud of that. Those are the shows that, when I look back on what I've written, those are the kinds of shows that I'm proudest of my work on.
Nice. You also have a fondness for, you know, one of our favorite haunts out there that oddly comes up quite a bit on our nationally syndicated radio show, and yet we spend a lot of time talking about the Duplex.
Oh, the Duplex. I love the Duplex.
There is no finer place that I have been fired from than the Duplex there in 1999, so I'm kind of proud of that. But, you know, a lot of
I was fired from Footlight Records in the East Village.
Look
in
at
my first
you.
Job in
I remember Footlight.
Vinyl shop. Yeah, I moved to New York. I was like, I'm in New York now. I'm going to work at Footlight Records. I lasted 1 week. All I wanted to do is look at the album.
How about the part where I moved to New York and said, I'm a singing waiter at the Duplex, and then I wasn't anymore. So, yeah. But, yeah, no, we've had Brian Nash and Kate Pizakis and all of our buddies, all the folks I used to sing with at the Duplex. For folks who don't know about, you know, kind of the piano bar cabaret scene in New York and are just looking at, we got to go see a show, extol the virtues of the other side, the cabaret and piano bar, why folks should frequent those haunts.
Well, you know, the cabaret and piano bar are two different things.
Yes.
And, I mean, they're often connected, and often they'll, like at the Duplex and Don't Tell Mama, for example, there is a piano bar space, and there's also there are also cabaret spaces. Cabaret is a hard genre to describe, but generally it means a small room with relatively small instruments. Lately, often with an emphasis on Great American Songbook stuff, but lately that's been updated. But, you know, lady at a microphone with a piano singing Cole Porter songs, traditionally cabaret. But now there are lots of other sort of alt-cabaret things, some of which I think are really great and hilarious and modern and funny and raunchy and subversive, and that's happening too. There's a wide range of material. So I love cabaret shows, and there are many places in town where you can get an intimate theatrical experience that you can't get. You know, you can see Patti LuPone at 54 Below, and you can see her performing in a room for 120 people instead of at Carnegie Hall.
Right.
And that is a very different relationship with a big Broadway star. And it's very exciting. I'm a huge fan of cabaret. I think it's a deeply underrated art. And piano bars are a different thing. Piano bars are raucous and fun, and there's, you know, the Duplex I like because it's open from, it's open all day until 4 in the morning. There's a piano in the middle of the room. There's a pianist playing songs. People get up and sing, either from the staff, or if you're a customer, you can put up a request and you can get up and sing yourself. A little bit like karaoke, I guess, except that you have a live musician with you. And so you can make a song your own in a way that you just can't with a pre-recorded track.
Is there an Adam Feldman signature get up to the piano song?
I have a bunch of them now. Actually, I'm at the Duplex so often now that I have my own songbook there. I really do have sheet music and a songbook behind the piano.
I love it. When I worked there did I have that.
Well, you know, this is a long story which we won't get into, but the very brief version is that there was a period when I couldn't sing. I couldn't talk or sing. I had a rare vocal cord disease. And I had 11 surgeries on it.
Wow.
And I didn't know if I was ever going to be able to talk again, much less sing, but there would be brief periods in between recovering from the surgeries when I would be able to croak out some notes. And what ended up happening, weirdly enough, is that that's when I started singing again, having sort of dropped it for many years. Just the gratitude of being able to sing at all made me much more appreciative of singing. And then when I got most of my voice back after this whole episode, I held on to it, and I go there really a lot. I sing a lot. I tend to do kind of pop rock, sentimental, gruff, sensitive songs from the 70s and 80s, like We've Got Tonight,
or Nice.
Hello by Lionel Richie.
Wow.
Or Don't You Forget About Me.
Oh.
That sort of thing. But, I've got a broad palette. I'm thinking of putting together a little music show of my own in the next few months, so keep an eye out for that.
We'll keep an eye out.
Because you mentioned Facebook, but my Twitter handle is Feldman Adam, by the way. I reversed it because some jerk in Michigan stole Adam Feldman 7 years ago.
Hate that guy.
I know. Seriously, he works in computers.
Not that you know. Well, we'll keep our eye on that, and we'll link to your Twitter. We'll wrap up with the question that we do. You know, we cover this topic quite a bit. And
sure.
Look, I'm very fortunate, and I've said this repeatedly over the past 6-7 years of the show. I'm very fortunate that I grew up in New York City, and so my folks took me to quite a few shows. And when it was at a time that theater wasn't necessarily pricing people out. You know, and
right.
An ever-present topic is we have this amazing art form, and so many of our listeners appreciate the art form or maybe have the desire to appreciate it more but can't access it because, you know, it can be so exorbitantly expensive. Do you see a solution on the horizon? Because I do get nervous that we will get to this point where it's just like, okay, well, I guess we could possibly afford a back row ticket to Chicago at the TKTS booth, but that's about it.
Right. Well, then I would say look beyond the TKTS booth.
Yeah.
It depends what you want to see. If you're really bent on seeing only a big, glitzy Broadway show, then you have, then either you're going to have to pay through the nose for it, or you're going to have to wait and see a late in the run replacement cast, slightly tired version of that show.
Okay.
From likely not a great seat in the house. And I don't know if that experience is going to be what you want either. Because I really find that there's a big difference in long running shows. Most of them, even the best, don't maintain that strongly. Book of Mormon has, and Wicked has. You know, there are some that Phantom has. I mean, Phantom is more or less where it was. But most of the other shows kind of do eventually trickle out of energy. It's what happens when you run for that long. They weren't meant to.
Right.
I think there's a lot of great stuff going on in the city in smaller levels. Especially if you have more adventurous tastes, you can find things downtown. You can find things in cabaret spaces like Joe's Pub or even 54 Below. Or even sometimes at places like the Duplex or the Laurie Beachman, there are lots of intimate theaters that you can go to. There are great experimental theaters all over town, or shows that companies that make a deliberate effort to keep their prices low. Soho Rep, for example, has very affordable ticket prices, and they do very smart and interesting experimental work. Not crazy experimental, not boring.
Right.
In the way that a lot of people think experimental theater is going to be. But if you want musical theater, there are one-off concerts. There are festivals right now. You know, the New York Musical Theater Festival is happening. There are dozens of new shows going on there. You're going to be seeing an earlier stage of it than you'd be seeing in a big, glitzy Broadway show. But also most of these, even the Broadway shows, are coming up with ways to try to democratize it if possible. There are lotteries. There are ways that you can find cheaper tickets if you really want to put the elbow grease into it. But you might have to try a few times.
Yeah, might have to put some work. All right.
Yeah. Or just make friends with someone very rich.
There you go. Do you get an extra ticket, or is it just one ticket for Adam?
I do. So make friends with me. Follow me on Twitter, and then retweet me.
They can follow you on Twitter. They can also read what you're writing on Facebook. Because as I said, I have to tell you, you are one of the most entertaining people in my Facebook feed.
Oh, shucks. That is very kind.
So you...
Now I'm scared of who else is in your
family. It's a gay Jew thing. I'm always going to gravitate towards that gay Jew thing. It's
That's
my...
right, and there's a lot of that in my feed. But, honestly, I was skeptical of the Facebook and Twitter, and I must say I've been having a lovely time on it.
Yay.
Some wonderful people. So, yeah, I'm Adam Feldman on Facebook, and I'm Feldman Adam on Twitter.
Awesome. Okay. Well, we will link up to that for our listeners. I've been reading your reviews for a number of years, and as someone who no longer lives in New York City, and many of our listeners live nowhere near New York City, it's kind of fun to go on there. It's maybe a little bit of, attacking yourself by reading a review of something that you probably won't get to see because it's far away, but you provide actually not just for folks who are looking at Time Out New York and are looking for something to do that weekend, but also folks who are looking at Time Out New York, looking at your reviews and seeing, hey, what's going on with this really vital part of our culture? And you sum it up in such an accessible and fun and sometimes snarky and sometimes very reverent way, not just irreverent, that gives all of us everywhere, not just in New York, access to this, again, really vital art form. So it's a great thing you're doing.
And I will say this gets on, I know you were signing off, but this is what I was trying to say before a little bit, is that part of it is, part of writing a review, as opposed to having an opinion, is trying to write something that's going to be entertaining on its own terms,
yeah,
even if you don't see the show. And it doesn't have to be negative, but I try to make the jokes that I make, I try to make them separate from just making fun of the show.
Yeah.
I try to make them verbal jokes or puns or observations and things like that, so that even if you're not going to see the show, it might still be an entertaining little bit to read.
Well, you are doing that.
Well, thank you very kindly. I much appreciate it.
Folks can stroll on over to Adam's Facebook, to his Twitter. You can also, of course, go to timeout.com/New York, and right there in the Arts and Culture tab, you can go to theater. You can also
click right on the theater tab at the top of the page.
You could do that as well. He streamlined it for you right there. Adam, please, please keep doing what you're doing, man.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
I'd like to propose a toast. Here's to the ladies who lunch. Everybody laugh. Lounging in their caftans.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, a ton of LGBT news to get through with you, with perhaps some of my own views thrown into the mix. The big story of the week comes out of Cleveland, Ohio, the place where I call home right now. You guys have all been posting on my Facebook wall saying, hey, the Republican National Convention is coming to Cleveland. And yes, indeed, I did see that the Republican National Convention is coming to Cleveland right there in 2016. It's going to be fascinating. I honestly, I think it's kind of groan-worthy, and it's not really what I want to see here, because the rhetoric that comes out of some pieces of the Republican National Convention can be so anti-gay and so anti-marriage equality and so anti-equality across the board. Now, the interesting piece is going to be that, by and large, if you're a Republican and you didn't see that your exclusionary stance did not help you at all in 2012, then you really missed the boat. That was kind of the whole lesson of the 2012 election. So the curious piece is going to be whether or not Republicans have picked up any lessons whatsoever from the 2012 failures to really get any candidates elected, any major candidates upseating Democrats, including, the president. So, will you change your rhetoric for the 2016 Republican National Convention, which will be found in Cleveland? Now, of course, a huge conservative element will be descending here on Cleveland. My favorite part are the stories that come out every single time there's a big Republican gathering somewhere that indicate, hey, by the way, all of your little gay hookup apps like Grindr and Scruff and whatever the other ones are called, because I have absolutely no idea, all of the participation in all of those mediums, they go up tons, because there's a lot of closeted people that will be descending on your city. So I will not be protesting. We'll see what comes up, unless something very overt happens. Unless they are saying, look, we are dedicating night two of the convention to just anti-gay people, I'll probably protest. On the happy side, it's going to bring a lot of money to Cleveland. It's kind of an interesting confluence, just because for folks who do not know, in just a few weeks, the Gay Games will also be descending on Cleveland. So there's a lot of huge events happening here in tiny little, what do they call it, second city? We're not a first-tier city. We're a second-tier city, Cleveland. And I don't think you get too much more opposite than the Republican National Convention and the gay games. So yay for an influx of money coming into Cleveland. And then we'll just kind of see how it pans out. Oh my gosh, it's going to be such a mess. It's going to be such a mess with the Republican National Convention here. We'll just see how crazy it gets. I'm curious to see if people organize, what kinds of responses people organize. So that is your Cleveland news that you were just dying to know. We'll see what effects it has. We turn next to all of the marriage equality. We could just do the whole show on this. We could do the whole show on marriage equality. And let me just pause here for a second. And I know I've said this before, but I'm going to just say it again. I hesitate. I'm a little bit ambivalent when I cover the marriage equality stories, especially something like this where I can easily spend the next 15, 16 minutes, what we have remaining in this week's show, just talking about marriage equality, because I fear that it convinces someone or it conveys the impression that marriage equality is the only issue out there in the LGBT community. And it's not. It is categorically not. But at the same time, there are so many developments happening in every single state that you really could devote the whole show, you could devote weeks and weeks just to talking about the developments in marriage equality. So I'm going to try to breeze through these quickly so we can get to some other stories, because there's some other great gay stories out there, but a lot going on in all the different states regarding marriage equality. We start with Colorado. A state judge has determined that a 2006 Colorado constitutional amendment forbidding same-sex marriage violates the U.S. Constitution's guarantee of equal protection and due process, which makes Colorado the centennial state the latest to see an anti-marriage equality law struck down. Now, the interesting thing about Colorado is that they have civil unions. So what we are finding there is kind of the 201 case, not the 101 of where we figure out, hey, the laws banning marriage equality are unconstitutional. It's the 201 where we're deciding, hey, like Vermont did, that civil unions, the existence of civil unions, that's also discriminatory. The Adams County District Court Judge C. Scott Crabtree, he delivered his ruling just this week, and he said this, quote, "The court holds that the marriage bans violate plaintiff's due process and equal protection guarantees under the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution." Here's the fun piece. He further said this, "The existence of civil unions is further evidence of discrimination against same-sex couples and does not ameliorate the discriminatory effects of marriage bans." And we talked about that a little bit with Governor Howard Dean when he was on the show last year, just that, yes, there was a time where it was like, if you have nothing and you can get civil unions, well, that's something, because you currently have nothing. Same thing with domestic partnerships in communities that have absolutely nothing. If there's no way you're going to be able to pass marriage equality, then yeah, I mean, domestic partnerships, civil unions, that's something that's more than you have, but it is still less than. When you have to create a separate category, it is inherently less than. So that's happening in Colorado. Very exciting there. It also did come with a stay, so these marriages will not automatically go into effect. They have to examine it more. I'm sure there will be an appeal. Because appeals happen, you just turn to a place like Pennsylvania, where they have been trying and trying and trying to stop same-sex marriages when they were passed in that state, even though Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett, he declined to defend the state's marriage ban, but the Schuylkill County Register of Wills, Teresa Santai Gaffney, her office issues marriage licenses. She went and asked the Supreme Court for permission to appeal the U.S. District Judge's May 20th ruling invalidating that marriage equality ban. So she filed this with the district court, which rejected it, and then she filed it with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, which denied the same request. So then she went to the Supreme Court of all the lands, and Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito Jr., he this week denied the Pennsylvania County Clerk's plea to stop same-sex marriages in that state. So that's the end of the road, folks. That's the end of the road for you in Pennsylvania, the last stop for attempts to end marriage equality in Pennsylvania. So that's in Pennsylvania. No further recourse for you. Try and try as you might. Gay marriage, it's there for you in Pennsylvania. Then we go to Indiana. Indiana Governor Mike Pence's office. Now, here's the opposite. We're just going to keep bouncing back and forth. So you got the governor in Pennsylvania, Governor Tom Corbett, who stands up and says, hey, we are not going to defend the state's marriage ban. His brother in gubernatorial office right there in Indiana, Indiana Governor Mike Pence, he is telling state agencies to act as if no gay marriages had been performed during the 3 days following a federal court order. The memo from the governor's chief counsel tells executive branch agencies to execute their functions as though the June 25th court order had not been issued. This is a fun game of pretend, isn't it? A federal judge in Indianapolis struck down the state's gay marriage ban as unconstitutional back on June 25th, leading to hundreds of same-sex marriages around the state. So folks ran out right then and got married. They had 3 days to do it because the appeals court stayed that ruling 3 days later after an appeal from the state's attorney general office. The governor's office then told agencies to recognize the out-of-state marriages of some couples who apply for marriage licenses, but now they are saying, hey, just pretend it didn't happen. I know it was in the news. I know it was on people's Facebook feeds that we have marriage equality here now, at least for those 3 days before the appeal went through and there was a stay in figuring out what to do, but let's pretend it didn't happen. Because if it didn't happen, then we don't have to recognize these couples who are coming and applying. What a fun thing. How do you act? How does that actually happen? If you're one of those hundreds and hundreds of couples who goes and gets married and it was legal during those 3 days, that little short amount of time, it was totally legal. And I think it will be again. They just got to go through the appeals process. But it was totally legal. And then you go and you present your marriage certificate issued by the state of Indiana, signed by Indiana state officials, and you go to claim whatever benefits it is that you are going to claim that you are rightfully by law entitled to because you were legally married during those 3 days. And then what actually happens? Does a county clerk turn to you and say, I'm sorry, I don't see you? Do they say, I'm sorry, I was told by the governor to pretend this didn't happen? Like, how does that actually work? That's fine to say, I'm sorry, we don't currently recognize same-sex marriages. So I could see them saying that because currently Indiana does not recognize same-sex marriages, except that some couples of the same sex actually are married right now. So I'm just interested in the logistics. The legal side, I leave to the rest of you. I leave to those of you who are fighting this fight on that front. I'm just interested in the actual day-to-day logistics of going to someone with your valid marriage license from the state and having them say to you, I'm sorry, we were told to pretend that the June 25th court order that gave you this marriage equality does not exist. Crazy. Isn't that crazy? I can't even imagine. I want to be there. If you're one of those couples that is being told to pretend that you're not there, please call me. Please send an email to ken@theshowisogay.com because I want to know how that actually plays out. Insane. Totally insane. In Utah, Utah officials have formally asked the U.S. Supreme Court to determine whether the state's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage violates the U.S. Constitution. Attorneys representing Utah Republican Governor Gary Herbert and Attorney General Sean Reyes are appealing last month's ruling from the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals that agreed with a lower court ruling finding that Utah's marriage ban violates the U.S. Constitution's guarantees of equal protection and due process. So now Utah, they are going straight to the Supreme Court and saying, can someone help us out here? We have absolutely no idea what we're doing. Well, and that's not really true. They want the Supreme Court to say, hey, can you overturn what the courts are saying here in Utah? The Supreme Court is under no obligation to consider the case. There is no predetermined timeline for when the Supreme Court might announce whether it will hear the case. So it's all coming down to the Supreme Court. This is coming into play very, very quickly for the Supreme Court to figure out, hey, what are we doing here? So we will keep our eye on that. Kentucky, oh gosh, we still have two more. Holy cow. Kentucky's ban on marriage equality has been declared unconstitutional as it violates the right to equal protection. A federal judge just ruled that last week. The judge then, of course, this is what we do. We don't just issue the ruling. They now know you also issue a stay of the ruling pending an appeal, which means that same-sex couples still cannot marry in that state. So they learned their lesson from Indiana. We're not giving you 3 days to get your gays married, because then we have to pretend that they don't exist. There in Kentucky, we're saying, yeah, get married, no, not right now. We're going to issue our ruling saying you can get married, and then we're going to immediately give a stay of the ruling because other people are going to appeal, so don't get married yet. So no 3-day window there. And then finally, in Florida, Miami-Dade Circuit Judge Sarah Zabel this week heard arguments in a lawsuit filed by Equality Florida and the National Center for Lesbian Rights on behalf of 6 same-sex couples seeking to overturn the state's marriage equality ban. Former Governor Charlie Crist, who is running against incumbent Rick Scott, filed an amicus brief last week asking for the state ban to be overturned. So Florida, next on the agenda. And I shouldn't even say next. That was something that we said maybe last year, 2 years ago, of what state was going to happen next. And obviously what we're seeing right now is that all of this is happening simultaneously. It's crazy. It's crazy. I'm sure there are podcasts out there that are just devoted to talking about the developments of marriage equality. I'm sure you can go look up Jared Wolfson. I'm sure that he's got a podcast or he's affiliated with some sort of podcast that is just dedicated to this, because you really could spend all of your time just talking about this. And indeed, I've spent quite a bit of time right now. And there's other news. There's other news. Mississippi. Oh my gosh, friends, Mississippi. Mississippi's Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that now allows business owners to turn away LGBT customers if they claim their existence conflicts with their religion. Now, this is a law that passed in April, and it was quickly signed by Republican Governor Phil Bryant. Now, it has gone into effect right there on July 1st. Several cities in Mississippi, including Jackson and Hattiesburg, are challenging the insidious law by passing resolutions affirming that all patrons are welcome. Can I just say, we're not even talking about churches. We're not talking about someone. We're not talking about marriage equality. We're talking about commerce. We're talking about business, and we're talking about the fact that we need to pass resolutions reminding businesses that all customers have the same type of money. I mean, that's really what we're saying. Equality Mississippi is distributing stickers that proclaim we don't discriminate. If you're buying, we're selling. That's the point we're at. I mean, great campaign, crazy that we need to have such a campaign. The American Family Association has found a way to take umbrage with the stickers. They said, quote, it's not really a buying campaign, but it's a bully campaign, and it's being carried out by radical homosexual activists who intend to trample the freedom of Christians to live according to the dictates of Scripture. That was said by the American Family Association's Buddy Smith. Local merchants and professionals like Chef John Currens bristle at the law's effect on the state's already inhospitable reputation. He said, quote, we're not going to sit idly by and watch Jim Crow get revived in our state. We're talking about commerce. I can't believe we need to have stickers that say we don't discriminate. If you're buying, we're selling. That's apparently what we need to remind people to take gay money. As if gay money is indeed different than straight money. Insane. Insane. On happy news, the United Nations announced that it will recognize the unions of LGBT secretariat staffers regardless of whether their home country recognizes marriage equality. The UN Secretary General said this, quote, I am proud to stand for greater equality for all staff, and I call on our members of our UN family to unite in rejecting homophobia as discrimination that can never be tolerated at our workplace. It's pretty darn cool. I like that story a lot. How about a Burger King story? I don't think I've ever told a Burger King story. Burger King's Be Your Way project, which was one of the first pro-LGBT campaigns by a nationwide fast food chain, that just wrapped up this week. It was sold exclusively, and that was only at one location. But still, it's a fast food chain's really big campaign. It was sold exclusively at the 1200 Market Street location in San Francisco. It coincided with the city's Pride Festival, San Francisco's Pride Festival, and it apparently featured the Proud Whopper, which is a sandwich exactly like the franchise's flagship offering, but it was wrapped in a rainbow-colored wrapper, which bore the inscription, quote, we are all the same inside. Proceeds from the sale of the Proud Whopper will be donated to scholarships benefiting LGBT college-bound high school students. I love that story. I'm a vegetarian who doesn't go to fast food restaurants, so I didn't have the opportunity to see the Proud Whopper, but that's exciting. We like when big fast food chains do things like this, and maybe we can expand it to more locations. Not just there in the San Francisco, but maybe in other places as well. So yay for that. Now, there is a story out there by our buddy Adam Ragusea, who is an NPR journalist in Georgia, and he wrote a story about this gay teacher who has filed a sex discrimination claim against a Georgia school. He has been working at the school. He is beloved by all the students. He's been there for 4 years, but he won't be leading the band or teaching the course in the fall. His contract was not renewed after administrators found out that he plans to marry a man. Okay. Now, under federal anti-discrimination laws, employers are not prohibited from hiring or firing people on the basis of sexual orientation. But this teacher, Flint Dollar, is working to change that. He said that when he was hired, he was honest with school administrators about his sexual orientation. But just a month ago, when he was letting his students out for the summer, he was called in to see the school president. He said this, quote, "When you're called in the last part of the day on the last day of the week, it's not a good sign. I was told that the bishop of the Diocese of Savannah called and expressed his concern that if I was to return, it would be against the teachings of the Catholic Church." Now, the big question is, what changed? Because he was out. People knew that he was gay. What changed was that he announced on Facebook that he plans to marry his longtime partner in Minnesota this coming summer. The Catholic Church's position against same-sex marriage is pretty clear, and the diocese said it supports the school and its decision to let him go. So this is a fascinating story, and you should go, you can listen to it. You can read the story, or you can listen to it right there on NPR's website. Just go to Gay Teacher Files Sex Discrimination Claim Against Georgia School, and it will pop right up. Now, the interesting piece is what's going down, as always, in the comments section. The story's only been up for like a day, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of comments. And I think we're not where we were even a year ago. We're certainly not where we were 10 years ago, where the comments by and large are just a really vitriolic thing. But in some ways, some of the comments are getting more desperate. You get the sense that some anti-gay folks, or folks who believe that religion really says being gay is bad, and that you can't be a gay teacher, their arguments are getting more desperate, and one of the only safe havens that some of these folks feel like they have is within the church. So someone challenging that, as this teacher is challenging that, it just kind of makes these commenters feel even a little bit more desperate. I mean, come on, this is the only safe haven we have. So for, it's either a bellwether or it's not indicative of anything at all in society, which obviously leaves every representation possible. I don't know which one it is. It's either representative or not. Just go to the comments section and read through some of these comments there on the story, Gay Teacher Files Sex Discrimination Claim Against Georgia School. And that, my friends, is a very, very brief wrap-up for what's going on that's gay in this world. It's mostly marriage equality. That's mostly what's happening right now. We have tons and tons of amazing guests coming up, and we, of course, want you to follow everything that's happening with us. The best way to do that is just to subscribe to our show on iTunes. Stroll on over to iTunes and type in "This Show Is So Gay," and our show will pop right up, and you can click subscribe, and then the show will automatically download for you every single week. You can also go to thisshowissogay.com, and you can see that we have an RSS feed right there. Click on the RSS feed, and that will automatically give you updates when new shows are posted. It's pretty much every Thursday morning if you are listening through our website or listening through iTunes and not on one of the many stations across the country that carry our show. If you have a local station, usually a low power one that likes carrying different types of shows that does not currently have "This Show Is So Gay," and you would like our show to be on your station, just drop me an email, ken@thisshowissogay.com, and we will reach out to that station and see if we can't get "This Show Is So Gay" in your broadcasting area. That's it for now. Tell us what you're thinking. Send that email on over to me. Send me your guest ideas. Get out there. It's Pride Month in a lot of places. Pride Month just finished in a lot of places. So the challenge is to make every month Pride Month, and to continue the awareness, and to continue the fight, and to continue telling our stories to other people. And of course, for you to continue using your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And while you are out there making a difference, my friends, why be gay when you can be so gay?